Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
Hi, I'm Isha Pandit. I live in Houston, Texas, and I'm a reproductive justice activist, among several other things.
Since the election and inauguration of Donald Trump, the Women's March, things like this, reproductive justice is on everyone's mind. But can you talk a little bit about the particular framework of reproductive justice and why it's important to think about that frame in this moment?
Mm-hmm. You know, reproductive justice is a framework that really came about as an intervention to the reproductive rights arena of advocacy, which sort of focuses on the legal right to an abortion. And so women of color activists came together to say that, yes, access to abortion is important, and also that it is not the only place where women's reproductive health care and autonomy is relevant. So, for example, reproductive justice advocates often include environmental justice in their purview because that living in environments where there are toxins are really dangerous for people who want to become pregnant or people who are pregnant or children. A lot of reproductive justice advocates also take on, for example, the issues of criminalization and police brutality because not feeling as though you can raise your children in safety is an issue of reproductive justice. So those are just some examples of the way that the reproductive justice framework says, yes, access to abortion and the right to not have children and to not be pregnant when you don't want to be is significant, as is the right to have children and parent them in safety and with dignity. And so what that does is open up the idea of reproductive justice to include intersections with a bunch of other issues and a more holistic approach to wellness and reproductive health.
And so we have Vice President Mike Pence, who will not be in a room with a woman who is not his wife, and who apparently just today cast the tie-breaking Senate vote on funding for Title X. Can you talk about this a little bit? This is an ongoing fight that often gets framed as defunding Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about what actually happens? What is actually at stake when they talk about going after this regulation?
Yeah, you know, actually, so on the face of it, I mean, it's relatively straightforward. They don't actually think that women's reproductive health care is health care that counts and should be resourced in any way meaningfully.
Right.
So that's what that fight is about. It's also symbolic takedown of the organization that is the face of, you know, access to reproductive health care and abortion rights. So that's kind of what that's about. But Mike Pence is particularly interesting because Mike Pence has been on a crusade in his own state to not just limit access to abortion, but to criminalize abortion, to make it a crime to get an abortion. And in Mike Pence's state of Indiana are the first women, the ones that we know that have been incarcerated for having abortions. And some would, the cases are, arguable also for having an unplanned miscarriage. And so Mike Pence is actually a poster child for the anti-abortion crusade at the state level because his state has been at the forefront of removing, access to reproductive health care and then on top of that to criminalize women who do get abortions. And, just to not to put too fine a point on it, but the law that was used to criminalize in 2013, Purvi Patel, was actually to criminalize her abortion or miscarriage, as she claimed, was actually a law that was intended to protect pregnant women from violence. And so it was to criminalize violence against women. And the, you know, under his leadership, that state used a violence against women law to incarcerate a pregnant woman who had had a miscarriage. So, I mean, his ideology on this issue kind of knows no bounds. And so, I think it's a really important piece of his legacy that is, like, of his political legacy in the state of Indiana that we just can't forget.
Yeah. And so, you know, we often talk about the issue of abortion, not we, but, you know, the conversation often revolves around sort of the Supreme Court and this fight that we have to elect a Democrat president so that we can keep the Supreme Court in the hands of, you know, a pro-choice majority. And so what happens, you know, we freak out about that, but then we miss these fights on the state level. So we miss what was going on in Indiana when Mike Pence was governor. We miss what's been going on in Texas where you live. So we'd love for you to talk about the recent anti-abortion bills in Texas and the organizing that's going on to fight those.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the past 8 years, I mean, I've been doing reproductive justice work actively since 2004, and so I've seen two sets of trends. Actually, one trend that continued since 2004 and is continuing now, and another one that has sort of flipped around a little bit. So the first thing is that there has been a complete, from the right, there has been an attack on access to reproductive healthcare and abortion access at the state level. The number of bills introduced has been astronomical. I mean, in the George W. Bush era, there was like an unprecedented spike in the numbers of state bills that were introduced to limit or eliminate access to abortion. And so that trend has continued pretty unabated, since then. I mean, the numbers are really, really hugely, so hundreds and hundreds of bills being introduced a year in state legislatures. So that is, you know, like there's no other way to describe it as like a concerted onslaught. It's happening at the state level, and in some places, coalitions are able, and, you know, reproductive rights coalitions are able to sort of beat those back or stem the tide. But the general trend has been a sort of piecemeal evisceration of the right to access abortion in states all around the country. And so what that winds up doing is engaging those, you know, activists at that level in reactive positioning. And so that's kind of where the movement has been for a long time, is responding to this overwhelming legislative attack on reproductive rights has been going on for well over a decade now. And at the federal level, that tide and that energy has been mirrored by federal legislators in introducing bills that limit access to abortion, defund Planned Parenthood. And so I feel like there's both of those things are happening. You know, the Obama administration was able to hold back, you know, some of the bills that the Republicans would introduce each year, and they would introduce them each year.
Right.
The defunding, you know, that would happen in Congress every time. So I feel like there's been, and that has not stopped, and it has not stopped now either. So it's been, you know, so when we think about what's happening in states like Texas, it's of a piece with this broader goal of rendering, you know, Roe v. Wade relatively meaningless because of the level of restrictions placed on access to abortion. So in Texas, you know, there are laws that require people who are seeking abortions to make as many as 4 trips to the doctor to get a medication abortion, and that have, you know, waiting periods, and that shut down, you know, what we call trap laws, targeted attacks against reproductive health care providers and the clinics. And so that is kind of we're still experiencing the repercussions of those laws for the past many years, even though we did have a victory in the Supreme Court last year, or was it two years ago, that, you know, sort of beat back some of the more egregious provisions there. And so that is continuing now. You know, the Senate Bill 25, actually, which, you know, they're calling the wrongful birth bill, which would protect physicians, from any legal recognition in cases where the healthcare provider, the physician, withholds information about fetal abnormality, if they believe that disclosing that information would result in their patient considering an abortion and terminating the pregnancy. It's essentially cover for lying, for allowing doctors to lie to their patients.
Wrongful birth, though.
And so, I mean, you know, and so this, like, I feel as though, you know, Texas is one of the places where other states that are considering these really far-reaching, restrictive, problematic, anti-choice bills, it's like the case study for those. And so activists here, have seen a lot of that coming and going, and it's become really difficult to even, they're so untethered to medical reality that it's about making abortion both impossible, but then also about a really warped sense of what reproductive health is and how pregnant people engage with the medical system and what happens when people stop trusting their doctors. I mean, it's really myopic approach to healthcare at the macro level, and then it's also, you know, it's pretty obviously about getting rid of people's ability to access abortion, even if physicians and lawmakers have to do that coercively.
I was just also in horrible things. We're looking at the Iowa State House passing this thing that would require someone to carry a dead fetus to term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the first time that I can't remember where it was introduced. It might have been Arizona, but those kinds of laws have been introduced before. I mean, just the level of, like, I don't even know, disregard for people's humanity is astounding. And what it would mean for someone to be forced to give birth to a fetus that they know is not alive and will, you know, or that they know will not survive. I mean, there's so many. I mean, it's really, really gruesome. And there have been so many. I mean, if you could just do a quick search of the testimony that women who have had wanted pregnancies talk about, the trauma that is, like, inflicted upon them. By, you know, by this process, by this medical establishment, in this way, it's like it's not even registering. I mean, it takes a particularly craven kind of person to feel like that is a legitimate way to restrict access to abortion. It's really astounding.
Yeah, and you know, I keep thinking about this in the context of everybody sort of making fun of Mike Pence, saying he won't be alone with a woman who is not his wife, and it's, oh, right. You really just don't think that women are people.
Certainly not people who are capable of, you know, of thinking about their bodies, you know, about, like, of having agency over their bodies. I mean, it's so regressive at this point that it's just, I mean, it would be laughable if it wasn't just so horrifying and traumatic for so many people involved. And, you know, one of the things, it's like there's this idea of abortion access as being about controlling fertility, and that is, of course, what it is about. It is also actually legitimately a healthcare issue. It is really right. important for people to be able to have abortions when it is a matter of their health and wellness. And I won't even, of course, it should go without saying that abortion should be legal if it will save the life of a pregnant person, but that even isn't a given with some of these laws where, you know, we've seen particularly religious healthcare providers refuse to do abortion services and people getting shuttled off to other hospitals and the delay resulting in the loss of their life. It's hard to overemphasize how dire it is to have politicians messing around with healthcare and trying to legislate healthcare that actually does impact, you know, it actually is life and death. And it's just so stark at this point that that we even have to keep saying, like, no, this is actually a medical issue. You should have nothing to say about this. You know, you really are not medical professionals. You should not be able to say what doctors can and cannot do. But then also sort of giving ideological medical professionals cover to lie to pregnant people is really, I think, pretty shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so I actually wanted to, in talking about the organizing around this, I wanted to also bring up the so-called bathroom bill in mm-hmm. Texas and the way that these actually, these things, I think, connect up in a way that you know, you see some defensiveness from the sort of older school feminists who want to talk about abortion and to thinking about trans people's rights in the same framework. And to me, it seems fairly obvious that they're connected, but hey.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you can talk about that in the same framework and especially when you see these coming out of the same legislatures in the same
mm-hmm.
span of time very quickly and the organizing against it connecting up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that wasn't the world's clearest question, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I think I got it. I mean, it's just ideologically, these are questions of bodily autonomy and the ability to both, you know, control your fertility, control your reproductive life, and control your gender expression and determine what that is. And to be, you know, I think the bathroom bills are really about trans people in public space. They are really an effort to make public spaces unsafe for trans people and unwelcoming to trans people. And that is, you know, that seems to me to be pretty clearly at the root of it. And because if you think about what life would feel like if you were unable to leave your home or if you left your home unable to know whether you would have access to a bathroom in which you would be safe and what that would mean for your participation in public spaces and in public life. And so that's really what that bill is about. It's about, you know, criminalizing and, you know, persecuting trans identity, especially because, and I can't believe we still have to keep saying this, there is no single case ever known of a trans person attacking anybody in a bathroom ever anywhere. But that just is not a thing that has happened. And, you know, also as though it doesn't need to be said, but here it is, there are also already laws against attacking people, be it in bathrooms, adjacent to bathrooms, or anywhere else. Like, you actually just can't assault people. It's a crime to assault people. It's a crime to do it in a bathroom. This doesn't make any sense. Unless you think about it as a set of laws designed specifically to remove trans bodies from public spaces, which is the only context in which it makes sense.
Yeah.
And so bodily autonomy and integrity is like a key tenet of the reproductive justice framework, and it's a key issue in this, and so these things are connected. And even if the ideological issues weren't connected, it's the same legislators proposing these things and supporting these things. So it's like of a piece with their worldview of who should be allowed to control what happens to their body and in what context.
Yeah, it just always strikes me as in both cases, they're trying to force you back into biology as destiny, right? So you are forced to, if you are born with a uterus, then you should be using it to reproduce, damn it. And
they don't seem to have a problem when they're like, you know, allowing for Viagra to be covered by health insurance in terms of like, so there's a lot of inconsistency with the biology is destiny argument.
Yeah. Yes.
you know, I mean, on a whole bunch of levels, all of modern medicine is sort of a fuck you to biology is destiny.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's so completely regressive.
In Houston, where you are, in Texas as a whole, there's been some really interesting organizing going on in response to these bills, and to this kind of agenda as a whole. So I would love for you to talk about that and how people can take lessons from that for wherever they are.
Yeah, we have seen I will start kind of, it was a really difficult election night for us in November, because it was actually quite bittersweet for Houston in particular. So organizing in Houston Houston is a blue city in a red, well, I would say in a solidly purple state, courtesy of gerrymandering and, you know, like sort of making voting inaccessible to so many folks in Texas. But that being said, you know, Houston went pretty solidly blue and supported Hillary Clinton. We also had two really significant victories that were a result of actively, intentionally intersectional organizing in Houston. And so those were the electoral defeats of Devin Anderson, our district attorney, and Sheriff Ron Hickman, who both campaigned, who are conservatives and who campaigned on a sort of racist law and order message. And they were replaced by, you know, Kim Ogg and Sheriff Ed Gonzalez, who both campaigned on progressive sort of pro-immigrant rights and pro-criminal justice system reform. And the pressure for those victories were really a result of local organizing. And this includes organizing by Black and brown communities to come together to talk about Harris County's jail system and how, you know, on one side of the jail is where sort of, a disproportionately high number of Black folks are incarcerated. On the other side of the jail is where the largest number of deportations in the country happens. And so actually it's the same building that houses these things. And so our community organizers have come together to do some shared agenda setting and to show up and to mobilize together on these issues. And it actually was a really significant victory for Houston, and a very progressive set of candidates, you know, who campaigned on immigrants' rights and criminal justice reform were elected. And so to have that happen at a time when, you know, what was happening, you know, like in terms of Donald Trump's election, it was really, it was a complicated set of things. So those coalitions that came together to form those electoral victories are now working together in the resistance. And so one of the things that you will see is folks from the LGBT community and, you know, from the sort of racial justice advocacy community showing up to lobby and to speak and testify against the anti-immigrant bills and vice versa.
Right.
So one of the most beautiful things that's happening in the Texas legislature now, and you can sort of see, it's really satisfying to see the shock on the, you know, legislators' faces when they're like, wait, what are you doing here? This is, you're not an undocumented immigrant. What are you doing here to talk about this? And, oh, you're like, you know, what are all these folks doing here to support the reproductive justice? You know, so it's really kind of amazing to see that happening. And, you know, Texas has been sort of by necessity, folks in red states have to organize intersectionally. Like, that's just a truth that, you know, Southern organizers in particular know, because of critical mass and issues being connected and the common enemies, et cetera, et cetera. But it is really amazing to see that resistance happening now in Texas and to see it happening intentionally and specifically and to be actually kind of building momentum. And, you know, the Texas legislature really put the bathroom bill and the anti-immigrant bill at the top of their agenda, and it has been the testimony that people came to offer that has shelved, I think, at least the anti-immigrant bill for at least for the time being. You know, now Texas's legislature meets only once every 2 years for, like, you know, 25 minutes or something. You know, so it's really like an acute period of time that we're in this spring with them. So it's hard to know how it will all shake out now. But there has been an inordinate amount of pressure, and that pressure has been intersectional. And that is really, I think, a singular source of hope for us in Texas.
Yeah. Texas is, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, happens in this moment is that you see these sort of think pieces about, like, should we just let the South secede and stuff like that. And so I think it's really important to highlight the excellent work that people are actually doing in these places that get written off so often.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, there's so many levels on which to call bullshit on that because, you know, not for nothing, as someone who I'm a New Yorker, I grew up in New York and have lived in Texas for the past a little over 3 years. My parents have lived here for the past 25 years. And so, you know, so I have this long relationship with Texas. And, you know, Houston is the most diverse city in the country, and it is also progressive. And so this sort of, like, odd dismissal that happens of the communities in Texas is, I think, you know, problematically elitist and xenophobic. But then the other truth is that the strategies that Southern organizers have been using for generations are actually the strategies that folks in that are influencing national movements right now. So communities in Texas that have had to do intersectional work by necessity are serving as models for folks that have been trying to do federal legislative work but can't figure out how to move national policy because they're obstructionist, executive branch, or, you know, they're coming up against congressional roadblocks. And so there's actually there's a ton of learning of how to work in hostile political environments that folks in blue states are using right now, and those strategies originate in the South, in red states, and more broadly from the global South.
Yeah.
So good luck succeeding, I think, you know.
Right. Yeah, I think, so I wanted to sort of wrap up here in talking about single-payer healthcare, which obviously we've also been paying attention to that for quite a long time. And in the wake of the complete and utter failure of the Republicans' attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, there's all of this renewed motion for single payer. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm. My first thought is, oh my God, this is shocking that this is even a national conversation. We're sort of, like, really, you know, banging the drums for people to understand what single payer was in 2007 and 2008 when federal healthcare reform was happening. And there was just a real lack of, I mean, there's a broad lack of health policy literacy across the country. People don't really understand health policy. It's intentional that information is kept from them. So people didn't even really know what single payer universal health care was, what it could look like, and what models in other countries are where people are guaranteed insurance, health insurance. And so that conversation is happening, and more people now know that there are these models that exist to ensure access to health care is astounding and incredible. And I also think and then I'll say that it was very satisfying to see that sort of Republicans crash and burn on this because, honestly, I mean, what have they been doing for 7 years? Like, I mean, at least 7 years, potentially not, you know, like, how, like, the, in terms of, like, you know, so what has been happening? And the just sort of, like, political defeat is really kind of staggering. And then there's, like, a more kind of complicated question, and I haven't seen much really good reporting or kind of commentary on this front. And this is question for me comes from the place of having seen, and I've worked on the passage of the ACA from 2009 to 2011. Particularly, I was working on women's health issues at that time. And so, but the role of the health insurance industry in this conversation is one that I'm really curious about. So it's a question that I have about, mm-hmm. I'm glad to see renewed interest in single-payer healthcare and or new interest in it. What I'm curious about is how folks are thinking about or whether they are taking into account the insurance industry lobby and its role in preventing that from being a viable solution when the ACA was being considered, and what we might do to sort of weaken that lobby or consider the ramifications or to build momentum to challenge. That's a question that I'm really interested in knowing more about. And if you've seen anything about it, definitely let me know. But I'm glad to have as much airtime as possible covering the Republicans' failure. And I really want to talk about, if people are interested in public health care, how are we going to make that happen? How could we make that happen with the current political structure being skewed towards the health insurance industry and its lobbyists?
Any ideas from your organizing on how to do that?
I think political will is really going to have to be, if I knew, my goodness.
Yeah.
But I think really the political will and the political momentum for keeping the conversation, constantly dragging that option back into the center of options, because it was eliminated pretty quickly from the possibility, from the conversation when the ACA was being negotiated, and it was sort of out the window as a pipe dream. So as long as you can kind of keep it in the center, it's going to take a tremendous amount of political will, and then also probably some, lobbying reforms, which, I don't know how we're going to get, but those two pieces are going to be key for actually making single payer a viable option, a viable federal option. But it most likely wouldn't happen at the federal level first, I feel as though. This is going to be another place where progressive states will do some leading, and we'll see that their economies don't collapse and that people move there to work and et cetera, whatever will happen. And then that is my best guess at the way momentum will be built.
So how can people keep up with you and your work?
People can find me on Twitter, which is sort of a hot mess these days, but I'm on there at Eshap, E-E-S-H-A-P. I am also writing at Salon, so you can find my writing at Salon and at the Crunk Feminist Collective, which is another place where I do some writing.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.